Bloomberg Surveillance with Ken Pruitt and Tom Keene. Listen on demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Now available free for both iPhone and Android devices.
Well, here in the studio, Tom Keene joining us.
Good morning.
Along with David Harrow, Chief Investment Officer at Harris Associates. Thank you for being here as well. And I'm going to start with sort of the same question I put to Mr. Gregory. You know, David, you know that they're not going to reach a deal for a while if they reach a deal. So why, as investors, do people keep running out and buying and selling, sending the market gyrating every time somebody down in Washington approaches a TV camera?
Yeah, I think it just kind of shows how spooky the market is. But I think the fact is we're starting to get used to this. I mean, there's been a couple of years now of indecisiveness, of waiting to the end, with coming up with Band-Aids. And so, frankly, if they come up with a real solution that works for the medium and long term, I think it will be extremely positive. On the other hand, you know, business as usual is business as usual. And I don't think it will be such a big surprise if they just find another Band-Aid to put on.
What is your enthusiasm to, like, walk in the door every day and look at where the value is or to monitor your equities versus taking a four-week vacation and coming back post-cliff?
Yeah, the enthusiasm is that stock equity price valuations are still extremely attractive, especially compared to fixed income. I mean, when you look at fixed income real rates of return, you have to go beyond the 10-year maturity to get a real rate of return. So people are so fearful, and I think this is reflective in equity market valuations, they're willing to lend the U.S. government money at a negative real interest rate.
You, I correct me if I'm wrong, but waxed enthusiastic about Japanese stocks. That is out there, a weaker yen, finally some Japanese action. Those stocks have gone nowhere for 4 years, have they?
Yeah, in fact, if you just take a step back, and it was 1989 when the Japanese equity market peaked at 40,000. Today, we're barely at 9,000, and we've had a little rally in the last couple weeks. But the fact is, what's happening in Japan are a couple of things. First, you're seeing a better focus on profitability and return structure of Japanese businesses, which is something that's been void, and it's still void with most companies, but we are able to find some companies that are starting to perform as they should. And when you combine this with the lowest valuations in the world, and then finally the possibility that they're going to tackle this deflation issue and this overly strong yen, means that there could be in a fairly explosive upward movement in Japanese stocks in the medium term. Very few people are exposed to Japanese equities. And I think when people start to see that it's bottomed, or if they perceive it to have bottomed, you're going to see a lot of people heading to the entrance door.
But isn't that a little bit like the old question about the bond market and when the rally is finally going to end in that? I mean, perceived that it's bottomed, how long could that go on with Japan?
Well, you're exactly right. Who knows what the exact trigger will be? I would assume that a weak yen is one of the things that may just perk things up. The yen has been too strong for too long. It has really, really hurt the exporters, which is an extremely important part of the Japanese economy, and the supply chain, the domestic supply chain that supports those exporters. So perhaps, and who knows what will happen for sure, perhaps this week yen and the election coming up in December may signify a turning point.
Daiwa Securities, we know that from Michael Moran, their chief economist over here in the United States. That's just one example. How does Daiwa Securities compare as a holding to, say, the more familiar names like J.P. Morgan or Morgan Stanley?
Yeah, I think Daiwa would be a perfect way to get Japanese exposure because they're directly exposed two ways to rebound in Japanese equities. One is they are the second biggest asset management company in Japan. So they have almost 20% market share. It's a high savings society still, and more people are leaving the 0.1% postal savings network to put funds in places like Daiwa. So that's the stable underpinnings. But the big thing would be is if you saw outsiders and a lot of people going directly into Japanese equities, Daiwa would be a huge beneficiary.
Off the bottom, up 49% since June of this year. There's symbols for that in Japan, folks, on the Bloomberg. It's a number symbols, how we do it. 8601. 8601 is the Japanese stock market symbol for Daiwa. Mike, David Arrow is too modest to talk about his track record. I'm going to go through these numbers and then explain them. Here's a partial score in honor of George Carlin. 98, 86, 98, 96, 98, 99, and 89. So if your kid came home with a report card that said 98, 86, 98, 96, 98, 99, 89, what would you do? You'd be like...
Well, we're going to put David in the gifted and talented program.
The gifted and talented program. That is his percentile return over 5 years, 3 years, 1 year, year-to-date, 3 months, 1 month, and 1 week. I'm not one that has looked at the 5,000 mutual funds out there, but I can say I have seen no other statistical return like that. Not only to do in the 90s, which is in itself admirable, that means that 90% of the people have underperformed you, but to do it across the time frame. I've never seen anybody do that. He would never mention this, but I'm going to mention David Harrow, year to date, up 21%.
I got 20 bucks in my wallet if you want to manage it.
Minimum investment is $1,000. We're happy to take.
Michael McKee and Tom Keene, we're thrilled to have with us David Harrow of Oakmark Harris Associates. I got that right, didn't I?
Yes.
Oakmark, right?
Oakmark,
right. Thank you. We were talking earlier about your terrific track record and the length of it, the ability to be consistently excellent. And in doing that, is it about more or less diversification? Is it about geographical bets? Is it about sector bets? Is it about what not to be in? Help our investors be wiser investors.
I think it's about two things. And one is maintaining a long-term investment horizon, not trying to behave as a trader, but trying to behave as an investor. And that means evaluating and determining what you think as a business is worth. And then, number two, having the discipline to truly buy low and to sell dear. All too often, investors become enamored with something that's going up, and they become fearful of something that's going down. And I think what it really takes to be successful over the long haul is to have that discipline to buy something that you are compelled to believe that it's, you know, worth, say, 100, and if it goes to 30, you buy it, even though it was at 40 the week before.
Well, what you're doing is becoming the intermediary who knows that between the person with the money and the markets. What criteria do you use to figure out when a stock is low and when it is high? Everybody says, you know, you buy and hold. But what does that actually mean?
Well, we start with the premise that the value of a business is really determined by the current and future free cash flow streams. So it's all based on what the company is currently generating in terms of free cash. And by the way, I didn't say net income or sales, but free cash. And it's measuring and predicting that future stream of free cash and discounting it to the present value. So that's our premise. That's how we value a business. We think a business is worth what it generates and what it has the potential to generate in terms of free cash flow.
What are you underweight? You've got a big bet on the banks, which clearly has been advantageous starting a year and a half ago, I'd suggest. But where are you not?
Well, we're not. You don't see a lot of energy exposure, utilities, or telecoms for different reasons. Energy, we believe, and you know, with the exception of what could happen in the Mideast politically, the dynamics, the supply-demand dynamics for oil in particular are not very good. Global energy or oil demand has only gone up a little over 1% a year over the last decade, and people don't even realize that. I ask people all the time, what do you think global oil demand's been over the last decade? And they say 7, 9, 10%. It's 1 or 2% a year. And meanwhile, supply is coming on from everywhere in places like, you know, North Dakota in the United States, off the coast of Brazil, off the coast of Africa. I mean, people are finding oil just about everywhere. Now, different cost structures, but it's out there. And even places like Iraq, that could be the next huge positive. It was only producing 2 million a day. It could do 7 or 8 million a day. So we don't like some of these oil. We don't like oil as an investment because we think it's abnormally high.
Are you okay over there?
Yeah.
I just thought you were compounding your $20 investment.
Yeah, I'm all the way up to 2101.
Harold works quickly.
Yeah. You don't like oil you know, in quotation marks, oil, but people have suggested that services, oil services, is the way to play energy at this point, because with all of these new developments in various fields around the United States and the world, those are the people who are going to make money.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You could usually find more capital inintensive ways to invest in either the energy sector or the natural resource sector than investing in either the miners or the oil companies themselves. I mean, we own a stock in a company called Orica, for instance, which is really a support company to mining. They make the explosives and mine chemicals. And often this is a better, less risky way to play these companies that are involved in natural resources. Utilities is another area, in telecoms, and you know, there's been such a flight to these businesses for this perceived safety. We just don't see good right. value there.
Europe, we've got to talk about it. Boy, it's gotten better. The yields have really come in. Can you be brave?
There's been a big move already. You know, if we're using a baseball analogy, we're probably in the fifth or sixth inning. What has to happen in Europe now is, now that they're kind of stabilizing the macroeconomic situation, the real problem with Europe deals with microeconomics and productivity. Mm-hmm. And why would anyone want to expand there and invest there?
So they don't have a free cash flow religion.
They don't have a free cash flow religion per se.
When I read their annual reports, it isn't there. Yeah, it's like pretend.
And you have to look at their local labor rules and environmental rules, and everything is just so hostile towards
now,
making money.
I got 20 seconds. It's killing me. Japan, do they have a free cash flow religion?
It's not a very good one, but it is changing with certain companies. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. The market paints it all with the same brush.
Right.
And if you could find a company like a Canon or a Hirose or even a Toyota, right. which is getting better, then you can make money.
Okay, David Harrell, thank you so much. With Harris Associates, and again, folks, this interview in its entirety, Bloomberg Radio Plus, you really want to go back and listen to this about some of the things not to do, some real wisdom there from Mr. Harrell.
Listen to Bloomberg Surveillance weekday mornings at 7 Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2012.